Chapter 11, the passion that blocks out love for others. So what passion is this? The first question gives us the answer.
Self-love.
Self-love, the passion of self-love. And this is a fundamental sort of a thing, you know. Think about these symptoms of self-love. And she's going to tell us what the symptoms are. Symptoms of self-love. Feeling more important than anyone else. Uncontrollable bodily appetites. Constant preoccupation with acquiring material possessions and satisfactions. Lack of deep concern for other people and creatures. Indifference to the suffering and feeling of others. What early influences do you think might feed and increase some of these symptoms of the passion of self-love in a person? Are there any early influences that you can think might help to protect a person from developing these symptoms? So these, how many of them are there? One, two, three, four. Just four, huh? What early influences do you think might feed and increase some of these symptoms of passion and self-love? Or otherwise, or the other way, what early influences are there?
Well, she was talking something about, like when you're a kid and people instilling in this, like, not self-worth, the prideful version of that, self-importance. We're, you know, just like talking about that as, you know, just, she was mentioning somewhere about, you know, when you're young, people, you know, really encouraging you to be, you know, think of yourself as self-important, and you could see that as being kind of stimulating to think, oh, well, I can, you know, like, you know, that entitlement of like, oh, well, you know, I'm important, I can do whatever I want, you know, it's about me and what I'm going to be when I grow up and what I want to do, and, you know, about less than about concern for other people.
Maybe grandparents, very indulgent grandparents. We have not had the opportunity to be that kind of grandparents for the most part, but some grandparents, I understand, do that. That the idea is their job is to spoil their grandchildren as much as possible. You know, I don't know. But
revenge,
yeah. Revenge on your children.
But I know a lot of parents who do that, though.
They do. And partly in reaction against having not been dealt with the way they wanted to be dealt with by their parents, you know, and I think, you know, that might be part of it. Yes, well, you know, we don't name names. We try not to name names.
I think that sometimes, too, that when there's a divorce, the mother wants to win over the child, the father, so they have two of everything, plus whatever they're bringing her. I mean, you know, just
right,
like
right.
On the same lines that they just are so indulgent, is that the word? They're just so, they get whatever they want, you know, especially if mom and dad are separated, divorced.
Right.
Two homes, you know.
That whole family dynamic between the mother and the father is just gone, you know, where they counterbalance one another. You know, mothers and fathers are different as mothers and fathers, and individual parents, whoever they are, the roles are not always identical. Sometimes fathers are more, you know, the way we would think of mothers being, and mothers are the disciplinarian. That happens, but it takes two. And then when there's a divorce and they're in the kind of situation you described, the child can become a kind of emotional possession, both parents fighting for emotional possession of the child and to try to hang on to their love. And, you know, how is that, you know, going to end up? Kids want to survive emotionally. It's a very difficult situation, for sure.
Your friends and family members, as we mentioned also, as being outside sources for influences for
right.
This as well.
I think just having a lack of a good example contributes to, you know, kids growing up with this problem of self-love, because, I mean, if you don't have an example of how to be selfless and thinking of others and really, like, processing through how to deal with situations and how to love others and how to, you know, like, you know, I mean, even here we're talking about, like, the bodily appetites, you know, there's a lot of parents who set a bad example for their kids, you know, in terms of, you know, sleeping all the time or eating too much. And that, I mean, if you don't have a model of, you know, how to behave, then I mean, it's kind of expected that they're going to grow up like that.
In our society, adult models of spiritual maturity are not particularly popular. Being one is not particularly popular. I mean, we don't even have, you know, I mean, I feel fortunate as a child to have had those kinds of models, you know, where, and, you know, but everybody wants to be young. I mean, older people, you know, Sharon's in my age, they, you know, the ideal is to try to continue to live as though you were 40 or 35 or something, or even younger, you know, to, you know, to fight age, and, you know, there's a youth culture sort of thing. It doesn't produce those kinds of spiritual examples of maturity. Isn't it interesting? When, you know,
yeah, and then we also do, I mean, there is a season coming up very soon, the great Christmas potlatch,
yeah,
where everybody, you know, indulges children to the utmost with games and toys.
And there's a sense of deserving all that.
Yes, yeah. You know, all this is for my child.
And that makes it okay.
And yeah, and our society participates in that, and most of us participate in it a great deal. You know.
I wonder what would happen to our economy if everybody became orthodox and ascetical. And, you know.
Indulge everybody as much as possible during that season, yeah. You know.
Television crossed my mind, you know, the influence of television. I mean, there was a time when the idea of appealing directly to children as a market would have been considered something that you just don't do. You know, you appeal to parents to buy things for their children, but at some point, you know, I don't know when, you know, probably when we were, at least by the time we were teenager children or younger, children were a bit, and I have to accuse William Boyd here, you know, Hopalong and Cassidy, my idol, you know, he was one of them, and he became wealthy by appealing directly to the desires of children to be like him. There's some good involved in there, but you know, he was the first mass marketer to children, no question about it. And you had sections in the store, when you go to the department store, it would be Hoppy's Corral or something like that, and everything imaginable was there, you know, for kids, you know. And then television is an interesting thing for me to think about, because it's been such a big influence on me and on all of us. I think of somebody like Mr. Rogers. I mean, is Mr. Rogers there? You know, you're special, you know, you know. Da, 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 da. I don't know if you listened to all that. I had to, because I put it on.
Eating their own way.
But the thing is, see now, the thing is that you have to say, it's Fred Rogers telling these kids that. It's not just anybody. You know, and his personality and his you know, his humility, his caring, his actual caring for children that he communicated right across the television. There was a kind of personal context. Mr. Rogers' world was Mr. Rogers. It was Fred Rogers made into a TV program. And so when he consoled people and told children, small children, that you are special, don't let yourself be, you know, just kind of feel like you're not good enough and all that. I mean, you know, kids, it's tough, you know, when little children don't all get that kind of affection. So I would not just come down hard on him as a particular example, because there's more going on there than just he's not inculcating self-love, I think. You know, his message, interestingly enough, for a televised or broadcast message, has more depth to it than that. It's more complex than that. It's more human than that. But it takes an individual, you know. It takes somebody like Fred Rogers, you know, to do that sort of thing without giving them the impression that, you know, you should indulge yourself, you're more important than others. I mean, concern with others is, was a hallmark of the things that he was concerned about. So he was a model, you know, I think.
He had a simplicity about him, too.
Yeah, that was him, I think. Mm-hmm. I mean, he was smart, you mm-hmm. know, but...
But our society in general indulges not just little children, but adults, too.
Well, there's money in it.
Yeah, take your, you know, you deserve this.
Right.
You know, you deserve
break today.
You know, you deserve to have a nice hot bath and candles or whatever. You deserve, and that's how marketing goes on. This
sure.
is yours, and so we're encouraged all of the time to indulge ourselves. And then our society goes on later on. If you're having trouble with your spouse, you know, you're fighting, you're doing having disagreements, you're not getting along, well then there's, you know, you're told, well, you've got to go your own way, you know, you deserve to have your own opinion, you deserve to be your own person, you deserve, you know.
Don't put up with that.
Don't put up with
you
that.
You have a right
so
to.
You're being encouraged to, you know, split apart, actually, in a lot of ways.
So if you don't get it in the home, I mean, you know, you're not going to get it. It's not being broadcast, I don't think, anywhere at this point. If you don't get it in the home, it's very, you know, but you know, somebody, there was something I read once that pointed out that in a parish, older people are just really important because they are mothers, they can be mothers to all the children, or grandmothers to all the children, or grandfathers or fathers to all the children, and they become models in parish life. So if parish life, if we have a Christian life going on actively in a parish, that's going to be a major influence on children. Because kids can tell, you know, about people, you know. It's hard to fool them. You know, they see through you. They see through your parent. They through their parents. They see through other people. If someone is genuinely loving and caring to a child, you are being a father or a mother, you know, to that child. And we all should, we all need to take that responsibility, and as far as dealing with one another too, that way. You know, in other words, you are not on your own. Well, we ought not, as Orthodox Christians, ever experience the sense of being on our own, you know, independent. You know, it's, I've got to deal with this all by myself. We have a responsibility as members of an Orthodox Christian community to support one another emotionally and spiritually exactly in this kind of way. I mean, we don't want to be a community that has no deep concern for other people or indifferent to the suffering of people in the community. So it's not just the home, but also, you know, the community life, you know, parish life.
Thinking about preventing or protecting a person from developing the symptoms just kind of makes me think about, I mean, my particular profession, you know, as a teacher and kind of my responsibility in that, you know, and I mean, it kind of goes along with, you know, your responsibility in the parish, but it's another aspect. It makes you think about the children in your lives and how you deal with them and what kind of example you are setting, especially, I mean, because I know some of the home lives of the kids, they're not getting that. They're
in
getting
the
overindulgence. They're
yeah.
not getting a good example.
No, we hear that from our daughter, Elizabeth, who teaches first, second grade. I don't know what grade she's teaching this year, but she's taught the early grades most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, that's, you know, we think of the schools, they're often criticized as being the places where secular humanism is taught, you know, from the beginning all the way through. Well, it's individual particular teachers, the men and women who are teachers, who are either going to do that or not do that, you know. And then sometimes people say, well, we can't teach religion in school. Okay, listen, we don't need to necessarily teach the formal teachings of a particular faith, in, you know, a particular Christian faith, and specifically Orthodox Christianity. We can communicate the content of the faith, and this is something that makes a special sense, I think, to us as Orthodox, by living amongst these children as teachers and adults who believe the faith by living it. That's how you can be an influence on children. And, you know, children are susceptible. I mean, if we are struggling with our spiritual life and trying to live as we ought to live and trying to deal with them in a loving kind of way, instead of, what's the alternative, secularizing them and affirming their absolute individualistic right to do however they please and just kind of doing that by all of the exercises that people come up with to kind of emphasize, you know, their independent uniqueness and lack of cooperation with one another and stand on your own and all that kind of stuff. There's no, I'll bet the schools don't have principles outwardly. I mean, you know, you don't get a handbook when you go to teach in the school and say, look, we are here to teach secular humanist principles. Here's what they are. You know, nobody does that. You have the material and it's about the teachers. Teachers are an incredible influence on people. You know, I know my Boy Scout leaders, especially my first troop, he was an incredible influence on me. And just by being who he was. And so we have a real responsibility in our own spiritual lives to be able to be the kind of person that has that kind of influence on others. Doesn't have to be packaged up as an official broadcast personality.
And I've noticed, I mean, personally, that it's not just kids who need a good example. Like, I mean, you know, like I had good examples growing up, but I mean, now that I'm older, I'm still looking for examples.
Sure.
Of people to learn from. And so I think it's good, I mean, with everyone you deal with, not just kids.
It's always a revelation to see that there is an adult who is capable of being, you know, this way and surviving in this messed up society that we have. You know, it is possible to do that. And really, in the deepest level, it is the natural way to be. When you see someone, you meet somebody who's like this, it goes a long way toward convincing you that's the way to be, you know, just because you know them. So that's the, you know. What does the Bible mean when it says that in the last days people shall be lovers of their own selves? You notice I don't have this highlighted.
No.
I ran out of time this week. My time was gobbled up. Now, of course, I read it aloud, and I read it since then without, you know, rigorously not letting myself highlight things, but I have not had the time to be able to do that. So I'm really need a lot of help here this week. It says on 192, that's where I guess the quotation is, "This know also that in the last days perilous times shall come, for people shall be lover of their own selves." I think, you know, when I read this, I think of what we've just been saying. In other words, perilous times will come because the people that you are surrounded by are people who are lovers of their own selves instead of being as we are described, instead of being as we believe Christians, you know, should live, to live like Christ. If there are people around you who are living like that, you know, then you can't do this on your own. You need to be amongst other people. But in these last perilous times, there won't be people like that so much. There will be people who are lovers of their own selves, covetous and covetousness, coveting material things and self-aggrandizing accumulation of things just for yourself, are accepted as normal. That's the way things are. Without natural affection. That is a lot more interesting term than I need to spend some time thinking about that. Without natural affection. Fierce lovers of pleasures more than lovers of God. I mean, we can't hardly read that without feeling like we're in the midst of that kind of, you know. So what does it mean? It says in the last days people shall be lovers of their own selves. And right before that she said, people with self-love worship and serve the creature more than the creator, without natural affection, unmerciful, never satisfied. Self-love produces sluggards always desiring something. Imagine that, you get to be kind of kind of like I feel right now, you know, physically, you know, kind of like slothful and sluggardly, and that makes you more desiring. And I mean, does that kind of doesn't sound right, but that's the way it is when we get into a kind of a state of being bored and we're not really applying ourselves, and that's when we desire. I want something, you know, I don't even know what it is, you know. Would you try to think of things? What do I want? You know, what will get me out of this kind of condition of being bored and not attached to being really involved in doing something? So there's a connection between being like that and being in the condition of always desiring something. You know, with self-love, everyone and everything interfering with or not directly serving your own appetites, lustful appetites and others, is ignored or thrown away and, you know, somehow gotten rid of, you know, including other people are dealt with that way. So I don't know, what more can we say than what she says there? What does the Bible mean that says, when it says in the last days people will be lovers of their own selves?
I feel like she explains it pretty well there.
Yeah, I kind of do too. Well, question 3, discuss situations where the instinct for survival can rivet attention on oneself and make a person indifferent to others. Can you think of any counsel to offer such a person?
I can see that part taking place as a nurse at my work. You know, you have, this is your job, these are the things you have to do, this is your, you know. So you're just riveting, you're focusing on your task and your things that you have to accomplish, and the patient becomes just an object
of your professional concern.
Yeah, you know, so you're not really focusing attention on them and being interested in them. It's just, this is what I have to take care of to do my job.
This is you surviving as an employee.
Yeah, this is my surviving as an employee. So and in that sense, I start treating people as objects or things, and they become annoyances.
That's quite a confession for a nurse.
Yeah. Well, it's something you fight against.
It's an odd profession. I mean, here they are. They exploit people. They exploit nurses. They don't pay them well.
Well, they do pay well.
You think?
I think they pay.
Oh, okay. Well, then I don't
know. For the amount of education that's involved in.
Well, I mean, the kind of job. I mean, you know, the attrition rate in nursing is terrible. I mean, people get RNs. How many of those RNs end up being functional RNs for the next 20 years? The dropout rate.
Actually.
Okay.
But still, yes, it's a
difficult job.
So they survive by what you're doing. What you're doing. That's the temptation, right? That you have to fight.
Yeah, I mean, I can see that being temptation in a lot of different types of jobs, you know. It's, I mean, the teachers could do the same thing.
Okay,
here's my students, and I've got to get this much information, they've got to do this stuff on the test, and I've got to do, you know, we've got to do this, and you stop looking at the child as a person, as a, you know, somebody that you love, and seeing them as someone you can to interact with, and they become an object, and then there's these children, these are bad children over here, and these are the good ones that do the things I want them to do.
Especially with behavior, that's where it's easy to fall into that, because you're just like, well, why can't you just do what you need to do? Like, and especially, I mean, I work with 4-year-olds. I mean, that just doesn't happen. You know, it's easy to just be like, all you have to do is sit there and listen. That's all you have to do. Like, you know, it's easy to think, well, I've gone through college and I have my term papers and all this stuff. Like, all you have to do is sit and listen to a story. Come on. But then you think about, you know, some of them who have been there since 6:30 in the morning, they're half asleep. And so, you know, there's so many different, like, there's some kids. I had one kid last year who, his parents didn't care to put him to bed at a specific time. So he'd be up until 2 in the morning, get there at 6:30 in the morning, and then you'd expect him to learn something, you know, or concentrate. Or there's the kids who just go home and sit and watch TV all day, and they get to school and they want to play and have fun and do something.
Sure.
But you're asking them to sit down. So it's, you have to really be concentrated on who that individual child is. And, you know, like, they are unique, and that's a good thing. But, like, kind of, you know, stop thinking about yourself and thinking about where that child is and, you know, how can you encourage that child to be a part of the group, you know, serving them in the way they need it.
There's so much that you're talking about that is so similar to being a pastor, it seems to me, because the particular point that I have in mind is that your responsibility is to try to awaken things in people that they are not yet even aware of the fact that they have. Mm-hmm. I mean, and young children are the best possible example. Mm-hmm. They have no idea of the things that they are able, you know, to awaken their desire to, you know, to understand, you know, and to change. Because I always say you cannot learn without changing. You know, and especially like 4 years old, 4 year olds, forget getting them to memorize a whole bunch of stuff for a test. I mean, you're not even into that yet, you know. So it's got to be even more focused on awakening a positive attitude toward hearing the stories, hearing what's going on, becoming involved with it, and all that sort of thing, you know. So you know, and that's a lot of what being a pastor is about. You know, is it what awakening things in people that they just don't even realize that it is in them? And you can't do that without, you know. First of all, if the kids or the people, you know, are in a situation where self-love is being encouraged, none of those things will happen. Because if you're being self-loving, feeling more important than anyone else, uncontrollable bodily appetites, all those things stand against the possibility of your waking up and growing. Emotionally, intellectually, spiritually, those things will keep you from developing, you know. So there's this spiritual aspect of teaching, and you know, that is very similar, it seems to me, to being a pastor. Instinct or for survival, you know, kids have that in spades, you know, and you know, they some of them are in situations where survival is what their life is all about a lot. Bad home situations, driven emotion on themselves,
all kinds of other things,
the hard cases,
like being in war, being you know, being a soldier or something like that. Being a person who's very ill.
Yeah, yeah.
Your instinct is, you know, dealing with pain and stuff. Your instinct is just to protect yourself, and so you're just indifferent to others, maybe the feelings of others.
All of these situations, though, are mixed, where there's a pull in both opposite directions at the same time, just like you were saying about nursing, that to survive you do this professional kind of approach, but at the same time, as a person who has come into nursing, you don't get into nursing, you know, if you just don't like or care about people, you know. And so you have that, you have to fight against becoming too much the other way. And it's the same thing, you know, for a soldier in war. It's not just individual survival. Those people die. You know, people depend on one another, you know, in a war. You know, that's the way it is. You know, and the person who lives who doesn't care about anybody but themselves, you know, no possibility of their looking out for the other person, sacrificing themselves for somebody else or for the group of people who have a mission. That aspect of life in war is just as real as the fact that you as an individual are in danger. There is sacrifice involved there throughout, you know, the life of a soldier. You know, I mean, we watch Army Wives, and I'm already experiencing loss, you know, because it's the last season. Wonderful, wonderful, wonderful program, I think. So many things in that program. There are so few programs on TV that have anything to do with real life. Their mission is to try to communicate what it is actually like to be a military family. And so they focus, as a consequence, on daily situations and the personalities and lives of particular people in this difficult situation, you know. And sacrifice is, you know, I mean, you sign on the dotted line if you are going to be married to somebody who is in the military, as far as sacrifice is concerned. You can't fight it, you know, and just reject it. And it's the same thing for the soldier, or male or female, who is in uniform. So my point here is that in all of these situations that we're mentioning, now with Mr. Rogers, on the one hand, message, you are special, but at the same time, the message is Mr. Rogers himself and concern for others. There is that pull, there are those two possible extremes that you could go with. And that the only thing that holds them together is the person, is some human being themselves. So it's a teacher, you know, even a broadcast teacher like Mr. Rogers, or a nurse, or a soldier. All of us as human beings have these pulls in these two opposite directions. It takes a real human being to be the person who makes a difference. You know, that's the only place where these things are resolved. You can't resolve them as ideas. You know, that's what makes so different. You know, situations where the instinct for survival can rivet attention on oneself and make a person indifferent to others, that is the battle and the struggle of each person. The teacher, the nurse, the soldier, it seems to me. And this, and, you know, can we think of any counsel to offer such a person? My shortcoming tonight is that I am not going to be able to, you know, drag us right back into the center of the text, because I haven't pulled the things out to be it. So if anyone has anything that they can recall from the text that speaks to this point, let's take a shot at doing that too, because we've talked nicely about the question directly. Does she have advice for us in this area? How do we avoid this? What's the alternative? People with the passion of self-love, I'm on top of 193, can appear to be very kind and caring, professional, moved by vainglory, professionalism, to make a good impression, wherein in fact they are hardly bothering to notice the sorrows, fears, discomfort, and pain of other persons and creatures. They don't pay you, but they don't pay you for that, you know. See, now you say they pay you okay for your education, but do you get paid for that? I mean, for when what? They evaluate you, do they say, you know, have you noticed the sorrows, fears, and discomfort and pain of your, you know, that's not what they focus on.
No, they want to know.
Make sure you don't give them the wrong drug.
Are you keeping up with that?
Are you getting your work done? Is that right now?
So each one of us in our lives, you know, we have the opportunity to be one way or the other, and to make this kind of struggle, you know, this spiritual struggle that our spiritual, you know, when we think of spiritual struggle, too many times we think about myself and my spiritual life. And the point here is that struggle takes place in what you do within the context of whatever you do in the world. And I think that's really important.
I was noticing in 194, she talks about the instinct of survival.
Right, there it is.
The analogy of the drowning person, you know, just that when you're focusing on you, you sometimes not only ignore the people around you, you can drag them down too. And in just thinking about survival, I mean, I guess I'm kind of like,
right.
I think of like times where I've had a decision to make or whatever, and, you know, I've not only ignored other people's, you know, thoughts or opinions, I've, you know, gotten mad at them, or like, you know, gotten an argument about them, and, you know, kind of dragged them down and started an argument, you know, and caused them, you know, to fall into sin because I was focusing on myself and what I was doing. And so, like, it just reminds me of the analogy that she's giving me.
the only way we can escape that is if we, she mentions Eve here, the only way we can escape that is to remember that when it comes to survival, we're okay. That's taken care of. We don't have to survive on the basis of our own fear of death or fear of things that are going to keep us from being able to build ourselves up and strengthen ourselves in order to survive as an individual. As Christians, we don't need to worry about that because that has been taken care of. And for, you know, all of that has been dealt with. We are free to go and live in the way that we are encouraged to live. And the thing that pulls us away from it is this sense of, I'm drowning, you know, death is coming to get me. You know, the influence of death in the world, you know, and all of that sense of not being able to cope with everything, that's the influence of death. If we were spiritually tied to the life to the reality of our life as Christians, we would be free of that. But we have to struggle in order to even have some sense or experience of that. But that's the antidote, you know, I think, to that sense that I am drowning. You know, I have to take care of myself. How can I take care of anybody else? The more we are free of that, the more we are available to other people. There's courage involved here, and that relates directly to the soldier example, I think. Can't be done without courage.
Well, when we pray, like we pray tonight, like asking the Lord to keep us from worldly cares and worldly, I mean, that seems like that would be a good reminder or prayer.
Absolutely.
Because then we don't have that survival. I guess that we have that anxiety. Mm-hmm.
If we pray that prayer in survival mode, it will make it mean exactly something totally different. You know, like, you know, ask God to take care of our worldly cares. Give us the things that we need, God, so I don't need to worry about them. And that's not what the prayer is meaning, and that's what you're pointing out, I think. What the prayer actually means is, keep me from being so focused on worldly cares, you know, because that is not something that I need to make the center of my focus. If I focus on being as I'm meant to be, which you have made possible, these things will take care of themselves. And it's not, now if you're a completely secularized and materialistic person, you will think, oh, well, they just believe that God is just going to shower these good things on you. And we don't believe that. I mean, you will be totally engaged in living the life at a practical level that you would live just the way you did before. The only thing that will be different is that you will be different. You won't be focused on those worldly concerns. You will be able to do your job, whatever it is, and completely as it needs to be done. And we're praying to be able to be in that kind of spiritual condition so that we can live that life. But just see how, you know, our focus, whether is self-loving and fearful, or whether we're not, it changes what that prayer means to us. You know, and if we pray it in the other way, this self-love, fearful kind of way, forget it. I mean, you know, does God hear that? I mean, we're no. He doesn't, he's not going to make us more, you know, confirm our self-love and fear, you know, by responding. You know, so that's obviously not going to, that is not going to be prayer that's going to make a difference. Really interesting.
I think the quote she has in 194 could kind of be a way to counsel someone who is dealing with a survival mode. You know, it says, examine yourselves to see whether you have within you a strong sense of your own importance. Its first demand is that everything should be as we wish it, and as soon as this is not so, we complain to God and are annoyed with people. Self-importance cleverly conceals itself behind humble words, settling itself firmly in the heart, so we swing between self-depreciation and self-praise. You know, just kind of in counseling someone, you know, I guess right. She's asking, if you're in survival mode, you know, are you thinking only of yourself? You know, and realizing, because for me, being able to diagnose what the problem is, I'm looking at all these symptoms that she's, you know, referencing, and that's, I'm like, oh, yeah, I do that. I see myself thinking that and, you know, doing that and, you know, seeing that description, I think would be helpful to, I mean, I know for me when I do that.
No, I agree with you. No, completely. I mean, I have a note to myself at the end of the chapter, you know, not to put up with in ourselves. And see, I've got some notes. Avoid spiritual self-deception, I will say. False humility, false piety, often so obvious to others but not to ourselves. And it seems to me that that applies to this, the self-depreciation and self-praise that we can swing between and think we're very pious, that we're very selfish and self-glorifying and prideful, and then sometimes we depreciate ourselves and we fall into a kind of a pious false humility and start talking as though we are humble and depreciating ourselves, and we're thinking, oh, now this is me being humble. You know, it's a prideful person trying to pretend to be humble by depreciating themselves in ways that are totally phony and everybody knows it, you know. But we even convince ourselves, you know. And, you know, so that if we're swinging between those two things, we're not dealing with ourselves or we don't have any self-knowledge, you know, as has been said before. This is really very realistic and helpful, practical spiritual advice, you know, that you're pointing out here. But we have, you know, we have to pray for to get out of that, you know, to break out of it. And to, you know, to, as you were saying, you do with yourself, try to become more aware of the fact that this is what we do. Mm-hmm. That's something that has to be done. It doesn't just break in from the outside. I mean, God is not going to beat us over the head with this. We have to participate in it, you know, actively. You know, that's part of our loving beyond ourselves, our loving God and our loving others.
And the difficult part is when you're in this situation and you recall something that you read or we discussed and then you have the choice, okay, well, am I going to actually do what we talked about doing, what I'm supposed to do? Or, you know, like, now that you're aware of it, or, you know, are you going to stay with the comfortable routine? That's one thing, going through this book, I'm finding that, you know, once you're aware of it, it's not enough. You still have to do something about it.
Yes. But it's something that you have to do. Lots of times people talk as though, you know, and in the tradition outside of our own, people will talk about, I wonder, God wants me to do this, or God wants me to do that. And 9 times out of 10, what we ought to be doing is crystal clear. And we're quibbling about, well, maybe God wants me to do something else. Maybe, you know, what we need to do is obvious. We do the thing that is to hand that needs to be done at that particular point, given our situation and our responsibility in our life, whatever it is. The thing that makes a difference is whether how we go about doing it. I mean, how are we spiritually in the doing of whatever it is that is our responsibility to do? That we can do it in one spirit or in another, and it's going to make all the difference to ourselves spiritually and for the others that we are involved with. And it's the same thing. So lots of times it's not a matter of does God want me to do this, or God does want me to do that? What does God want me to do? He wants us not to be filled with self-pride. He wants us to, you know, to struggle for love of Him and others. That's what He wants to do, you know, wants us to do. And He wants us to do that in every one of those situations where something needs to be done. You know, just as a matter of course, if you see what I mean. So it's not a matter of God being, you know, my God is my co-pilot with respect to how what is going on inside of my soul. You know, not God is my co-pilot when it comes to am I making the most successful spiritual choice, and, you know, going this way or that way in deciding to, you know, to move to Tacoma or stay in Tacoa or whatever it is. You know, gee, what does God want me to do? You know, when you go to Tacoma, it's going to be the same because you'll be there, you know. And He will still want you to do the same things that He wanted you to do in Tacoa, you know, internally.
It's just a challenge sometimes when you do know the clear path to actually choose to do it.
Yeah, and you can't do it without this dealing with these things that we're talking about in this book, and without wanting, you know, to pray to God and to be as we need to be. That's the only way that we can do those things in the way they need to be done. Okay, number four, how can self-importance make a person go from feeling first highly elated and then downcast and faint-hearted?
I think that what she said here, that you can swing between self-deprecation and self-praise, well, or self-praise and self-deprecation. What can happen, what can lift you up, and you can say, oh, you know, I can do this, I'm this kind of person, and then you have all these goals and self-oriented things, and then you don't live up to them, and then all of a sudden you're depressed about it. You know, it's because you find out that your self-interest and the only thing that you have is the self-interest you want. It's you're depressed because you can't do what you want to be able to do. So you can swing in the other way, you know.
The same things that build you up when your project of vainglorious self-importance are the things that depress you when you crash.
I have this. And your crashing is just, it's still more of just the self-interest.
Exactly.
You're deprecating yourself against yourself. Oh, I'm a terrible person. I can't lose this weight, then I eat too much, and I do this, and I'm terrible, I have no control over this. And it's just basically more me.
What do you have, Stephanie?
I was just going to say, I had, like, just the, you know, ups and downs. It just reminds me of high school for me, in terms of being in the youth group, and we'd go on a retreat, and I'd go and be on my spiritual high, and be like, oh, I'm so close to Jesus. I'm going to go and read my Bible every day, and I'm going to, you know, pray, and, you know, do all this stuff, and like, you get on that, you know, like, really, because it's all emotion-based, and it's all about yourself and how I'm feeling, and I feel close to Jesus, so I'm doing good spiritually, and then I go home, and I get so frustrated, because I'm not doing what I'm supposed to be doing, and I don't feel close to God, you know, and that's one of the things I just, you know, I was always frustrated with, you know, throughout high school, you know, just those, you know, one minute I'm like, oh, I'm doing so great, you know, I'm living for Jesus, and then the next minute you're like, you realize I'm not, and, you know, like, you kind of beat yourself up, it's like, oh, I didn't, you know, you read the Bible today, or I didn't pray, or, you know, and it's just going back and forth, and because you're focused on yourself and what, you know, like, how I'm feeling, and, you know, the way I'm dealing with things, but it's realizing that's, you're taking something, you know, spiritual is supposed to be, you know, there's a way to do things, and you're just making it about yourself, and it's like, oh, I did good today, you know, I mean, even now, I said my prayers this morning, I'm doing good, or, you know, realizing, oh, I forgot to pray this morning, getting down and focusing on yourself instead of the reality of, you know, the incarnation of Christ and living in at union, you know, with the people in church and with Christ, and making a medium in something that's supposed to be godly and about yourself.
Right.
So it's easy to go through those waves of praise and depreciation.
Yep. Self-deprecation, yep. Question number 5, discuss why the symptom of laziness for spiritual action accompanies self-love. Laziness for spiritual action.
That's what you were talking about. Then,
yeah. It is. These questions often do seem to, you know, they fade from one end to the other, and so sometimes we end up answering mm-hmm. the question after, which is because they follow after. Mm-hmm. You know,
I was mentioning before that I was reading this chapter earlier, and I was just like, this was the worst chapter, because I got up so early this morning, I was falling asleep, and I read it, and then it was right after I had read, untimely and immoderate sleep comes whenever the soul is slack concerning thoughts of God. And I'm reading this as I'm, you know, half falling asleep because I'm so tired. I'm just like, that's just a challenging thought right
it's
there.
It's not fair that it comes when you're so vulnerable. This direct criticism. A common symptom of self-love, it says on the top of page 195, say the saints, is laziness, being weighed down by the inertia of the flesh, as Anthony called it. This laziness comes from a strong dislike of reality and of God's will, a desire not to hear about them. This is where television is so great. You know, I mean, that's when we, you know, there's television, turn it on, that's it. You wipe out the whole evening and you've got inertia, you know, you've got distraction, you don't have to think about all this stuff. Basil the Great says, nothing renders the soul weaker, more negligent, more senseless than self-love. Produces a strong and overpowering laziness for action. Discontent over everything. Why am I not getting the satisfaction out of self-love that I deserve? And the commercials tell us, you know, well, I have to admit those commercials, they're always for somebody else, so they're not very good at speaking to my desires even. Well, we can do this part. We can criticize, sharpen our complaints, increase our dissatisfaction, focus attention on fleshly concerns of the self. Okay, that's the stuff. What sounds all too familiar. Isn't it sad that we have a tradition that knows us so well? It's been there all these, you know, what, 2,000 years. It's the same old stuff. And when we're in the middle of it, we just feel like it's all about us. And I'm all alone. I'm going through this. Number 6, what causes it? What causes impulse behavior? Question number 6. What do the saints say about impulse behavior?
Of course.
Oh, well, Walmart is... Or sure they do. They whole place is organized to encourage impulse buying. And then they move it around. You know, so you can't just go in and find things. You know,
she walked down that aisle and said,
and then necessities are in the back, like the milk. You have to walk through everything to get to the milk.
And the
eggs.
And then right next to the eggs.
You can't just walk out there and get
to the milk. So which Walmart's that causes impulse behavior?
That little yellow smiling face. No.
Well, 195. It's self-love.
John of Damascus, the quote from him, when one is impelled to action, this is called impulse. In the case of creatures without reason, as soon as appetite is aroused.
More loudly and more slowly.
Sorry. I'm mumbling as I read.
Fight falling into an intellectual whisper. Go ahead.
When one is impelled to action, this is called impulse. In the case of creatures without reason, as soon as appetite is aroused for anything, straightway arises impulse to action. for the appetite of creatures without reason, without a thinking power that's able to curb impulses, is irrational, and they are ruled by their appetites.
And we're in a condition of self-love when we are functioning that way. That seems clear at this point. I remember the big crash, the I used to call it in my way at the time. This is my late 20s, the ego crash, you know. Passion was no longer sufficient to move me. You know, as though that's the way it's supposed to be. You know, everything's supposed to be impulse charging, you know. I want this, I want that, what do I want now? Wow, you know, and just that's it. And then a point comes when there's a crash, you know. What's the matter with me? I don't want things like I'm supposed to. And then start trying to figure out, and eventually I did figure out, well, that's not how you're supposed to be at all, you know. It takes a long while to get to that point. You know, it took me a long while to get out of that. But I remember the particular moment where I realized that I had that my desires and passions were not sufficient to give me meaning in life. That was last week's topic. You know, we talked about people who reached the point where suicide, you know, they consider suicide because they realize that living like that is meaningless. You know. So, what we want to get back to is living impulsively and building up our self-love and all of that, because we're like addicted to living like that. It's the only way we know how to live. And now, in our tradition, our understanding, our point of view is, that's abnormal. We're being advised against that, you know. You could go, I'll bet you, to a psychiatrist who would try to get you back to that. Well, you don't have any joy of life, you know. You need to go out and change of scenery. Maybe a new wife or a new husband or something might do the trick for you, you know. And encourage exactly this kind of self-loving, impulsive, you know, kind of behavior. But what did they say cause? And I used to, did we get the cause of it? It was a good description of impulsive behavior and how it's related to self-love. What is the cause? Somewhere in here is a cause.
At the bottom of 195.
Okay.
An urgency to act on impulse also comes out of self-love. It establishes a habit of behaving on impulse without stopping to consider and evaluate an action before taking it. It leaves a person squirming for self-expression, either because of feeling important or because of wishing to feel important, say spiritual counselors. There is an irresistible urge to draw attention to the self, often by exuding charm and enthusiasm, or by undue attention to bodily ailments, or by stirring up crisis situations that can attract attention, or, as the saints quite often mention, by loquacity.
Yep.
Impulsively.
Being loquacious, talking a lot.
Okay, that's what that means. Impulsively reciting one's opinions at length.
Yes.
Self-love originating in the flesh is what spawns such carnal impulses and gives tremendous force to impulsive self-assertion.
Okay. I think we're done with that question.
Very clear.
Question number 7, how does self-love move people to do things that diminish their lives, to lose resources, security, and personal connections that would have been beneficial to them? Can anyone lead us to the core of things here? Let's see, before, after,
that first paragraph just above that.
This one?
I believe so.
Okay.
If life is just fleshly existence, as persons with self-love consider it to be, then it is loved when it gives pleasure and comfort, and hated when it gives displeasure and discomfort. So when there is prolonged frustration of its carnal demands, self-love gives a person a deep and habitual discontent of a kind of quiet hatred of life, hatred of its repeated disappointments, of certain persons in it, of what one sees as its hard circumstances and discouraging trials. Self-love works to destroy anything that benefits us spiritually and psychologically, which can include physical and material well-being.
There's a direct answer to some of our points.
Through the discontent, the quiet hatred of life that it can produce, ingrained self-love moves people to do things to diminish their lives, to kill or throw away important sources of their happiness. It forces its victims to separate from other people and creatures that have been close companions and from resources and places that could have greatly blessed them, say the saints.
Right. Yeah. This is it. I'm out of here. You know, I'm finished with this guy. I'm going to Tacoma. People do that. They want to do it, and sometimes when they don't do it. But if you know, when you want to do it and you don't do it, you can do it inwardly, and it amounts to the same thing. You know, you're just not there. You might as well have gone to Tacoma. You know, because you're not engaged with whoever you happen to be married to, or other members of the family, or your friends, because you cut yourself off and you just kind of get into a funk and all by yourself.
I think it's a good analogy that she starts in the beginning of the chapter, but here she reminds us, like, the analogy to intoxication, you know, where you just lose your good judgment and, you know, you're just living for your, you know, carnal desires, and that's when you get into that, you know, survival and, like, oh, well, this isn't making me happy, and it's not helping me, so I'm going to put that away. You know, you end up losing so many of the things that, I mean, that would bring you true happiness, because it would bring you, you know, spiritual peace.
It's pretty amazing that all of these things, I mean, the answer to most of these questions so far is self-love, is, you know, is responsible for all of this stuff. And it's it, you know, we feel sorry for ourselves and all of that.
Mm-hmm. Well, it seems to me that self-love also, when you have self-love, it redirects any responsibility that you may take. Like, if you do something, you're not responsible because you're better than that. Or, you know, it seems like it redirects. And there might be somebody who you want to blame for your problems, your unhappiness. That's kind of what that sounded like.
Justification. It affects the way you're able to confess your sins, too. You can confess your sins from in a self-loving kind of condition. And even if you avoid blaming the other people who are really responsible for your having sinned, you can avoid mentioning their name and confess whatever sin it is you're confessing, but you're just not dealing with reality, because we are so focused on ourselves that when we do confess things that we've done that we know we ought not to have done, we really feel justified in having done it. And, you know, even if we can avoid blaming it on other people, we could also fall into that self-deprecation business, and it will do for humility, you know. So self-love is completely dominate our spiritual life, you know.
But can you kind of tell when, I mean, because there is a difference to me when you can avoid
blaming
others, but to actually take responsibility on yourself.
I don't think you can do it. I don't think you can do it as long as you focus in your preparation for confession. We have to think of Christ, the saints, regain some kind of sense of how things ought to be with us. That we see our sins best by looking at Christ. I mean, that can mean nothing. I mean, somebody can say that it can mean nothing at all. But I, you know, in a lot of ways in this book, we are getting down to the specifics of what it means to be Christ-like and to live life as someone who is inspired by the love of God. The choice is between the love of God and others rather than ourselves. Unless we make that move toward God and others, our confession is going to be about us, mm-hmm. not about how we are not as we ought to be with respect to God and others. So I think that makes a difference. We can confess, you know, and just do the best we can without reorienting ourselves toward God and others, which we have got to do. That's critical as part of our preparation for confession. It's not purely, it's not simple self-analysis mm-hmm. on the basis of our own standards of what we ought to be like.
See, a lot of times I go to confession, I feel like that.
Sure.
I feel like just self-analysis. I mean, I know it goes deeper than that, but I think, like for me, it kind of started there because I didn't grow up. I didn't know how to do confession.
Sure.
I didn't, you know.
Well, it's like the kids. It's like the exactly. kids in school. We are capable of things that we have not experienced, mm-hmm. you know, and life together in the faith that we share. In our common life in the church, we become aware of those things. And then we have the choice whether we're going to affirm those things and try to move in that direction or whether we're just going to draw back and be self-justifying and, you know. So it's just like those kids learning, you know. We are capable of more. We are capable of living lives like the saints. Not being... You know, but moving in that direction. We are all capable of that. Those are the things that are doable. Remember that chapter where we talked about what was possible and what's impossible. Thank you for all your help. Next time we'll begin question number 8.